Today on Maine Calling, up to camp, a Maine tradition. If you moved to Maine from somewhere else, you probably remember wondering, what do people mean when they say they're going up to camp? Soon you learn that camp is not a tent in the wilderness, but rather a rustic cabin or maybe even a really nice house on a lake or river where the family gathers for the summer. The lucky few have camps that have been in their family for generations. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we learn about the origin and tradition of camps in Maine. A new exhibit at the Maine Maritime Museum in Bath explores how camps are intertwined with history and so much of what Mainers find precious: inland waterways and outdoor recreation. What does camp mean to you? Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling On Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. By Welch & Forbes, working with clients to manage the full range of events that come with building wealth, from investments to trustee services. More at WelchForbes.com. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, supporting Maine island communities through education, health, and community engagement. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Going up to camp is not just a funny catchphrase in Maine. It is part of the state's history and culture. Today, we're going to learn more about the evolution of Maine camps and how they can vary. Joining me, Catherine Sear, Associate Curator at Maine Maritime Museum, who put together the new exhibit called Up to Camp. Ryan Eldridge, a team member with the reality TV show Maine Cabin Masters, where a team of builders renovates old Maine cabins and camps. He's joining us from the field. They are shooting today. And Ian Stevenson, lecturer in preservation studies at Boston University, who lives on Peaks Island. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you have a camp? Do you have memories of going to your grandparents' camp? What makes the whole thing special to you? Send us a brief email, talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Welcome to all of you. Thank you so much for joining us. Catherine, I'm going to start with you because I understand this exhibit grew out of an academic project that you did. Why did you have the idea that camp, going up to camp, might be worthy of academic inquiry?
Mainly because it hasn't been part of sort of the academic world. I was in graduate school during the height of the pandemic and needed to find a topic that I had access to, could research without fear of being cut off from research archives, museums, so on and so forth. And in the back of my head, I'd always known, well, what if I could do something about camps? And specifically, I had my my then partner, my now husband's family camp on Worthley Pond in Peru, just a 19 teens bungalow, and thought, what if I studied it architecturally? What would it mean? How could I find a way to think about this? And my academic interests and professional interests have always been in studying the history and material culture and architecture of Maine, and it just fit perfectly to study this topic and dive right in.
So any surprises?
Oh, always along the way. I think the best thing was all the conversations that I had with multiple camp owners. So I had the opportunity to do field work through Moosehead Lake region, Ragely Lakes region, then with my own, now family members, to really talk about what camp means to them and how it's evolved over time. Just really special because everyone has sort of a unique connection to it, and everyone loves to talk about things that they love. So,
well, Ryan, that cues you right up. I bet you have conversations all the time with people about the places that you take care of, you rehabilitate, you transform, what they mean to them. What can you tell us from your experiencing now over several years of doing Maine Cabin Masters? And by the way, I think it's kind of funny, it's called Maine Cabin Masters. And I'm guessing that's because people who might watch your TV show in a place other than Maine wouldn't know what Maine Camp Masters is, right?
Yeah, and I think Maine Cabin Masters does ring a little bit better, you know?
But, so tell us about some of the conversation. What does camp mean to the people you work with?
Well, you know, to me, growing up in Central Maine, everyone had a camp. And, you know, we've been doing our show now for going on 10 years. And over that time, the biggest thing that we've learned is a camp can be a $5,000 hunting check up in the Allagash for one family. It can be a beautiful lake home on Cobbessey Lake, or it can be a multi-million dollar house on the ocean. But it's really a place where a family goes or people go to get away from everything, you know, to spend, to make memories of their family, to forget about work. You know, it took me a long time to understand that, you know, camps, going to camp, you know, it's not necessarily, doesn't have to be three seasons. It can be four seasons. It's more the idea of it, in my opinion, you know.
So camp and growing is up, more of a state of mind than a place.
A state of mind with a place for each family. Correct.
Well, but you guys know what I'm saying. I want to turn to you, Ian. I understand that you are able to connect this whole idea of going to camp in Maine with the years after the Civil War. How are those connected?
No, that's exactly right. You know, before the Civil War, most Americans had no experience camping at all in tents. And what ends up happening is a huge number of men learn how to camp outdoors, how to pitch a tent, how to do a campfire, how to gather firewood, etc. And they bring this knowledge back afterwards, and they're longing for this experience of kind of getting outdoors to remember the most pleasant experience of their wartime, which was time in camp. So the earliest camping guide ever published in the United States was by an author named John Mead Gould, who was from Portland, Maine. He was a bank teller, and it's called How to Camp Out. It was published in 1877, and he describes how to camp based on his military experience. But he says that camping has this restorative capacity. So he's exhorting people to get outside, get into nature for their own personal sort of well-being and healthfulness.
Catherine, go ahead, Ryan.
That kind of ties into what I was saying. You know, just, it doesn't have to be a physical structure, you know. It could be a piece of land, but it's, like Ian was saying, it's a place where, you know, you better yourself as well, you know, mentally and physically resting.
And before this call, I pulled up the entry of the word camp from the Dictionary of American Regional English, which describes it as a summer dwelling, whether modest or elaborate. And it even has a quotation from a book from 1880 called Picturesque Maine, which says, here and there are commodious buildings for the entertainment of sportsmen, still preserving their generic name of camps, the memory of earlier, less elaborate shelters. So as early as the 1880s, people were using this term camp for buildings that talk about sort of just getting outside and getting outdoors.
Catherine, I want to ask you about the phrase up to camp. Do we know where that came from, why you're going up to camp as opposed to down to camp or over to camp? Or
No, I mean, good question, right? And it at this point, especially in sort of like the Maine vernacular sort of language, it's something that we just know. And we know it is U-P-T-A, not U-P-T-O. Like, it has to be one word. And I think that just comes from the way that we speak. Sometimes we shorten words. But really, it has to do with the fact that, you know, people had to go inland Maine. They had to go up into the woods to find these sort of untouched wilderness stations, these, you know, vast landscapes that are covered with forests and teeming with lakes and streams. And of course, we know that this was not, you know, untamed wilderness. We had had indigenous populations in these areas for hundreds and thousands of years, but for sort of these white, you know, colonial settlers, this was unfettered territory in a way that they could find, as Ian was saying, these sort of restorative qualities and quantities, and also be able, in large ways, escape sort of their industrial homes and big cities that they wanted to get away from.
Yeah, and I want to circle back to that idea a little bit. Ryan, I want to ask you, though, what is the oldest camp that you've worked on? And have you found anything really awesome sort of in the floorboards or in the walls?
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you say that? Right now, we're working on we're actually taking a building that was originally a camp in the 50s on Anabasakook. And the parents had just passed away in the last couple of years. And the kids, you know, in the 70s and 80s, want to bring it back to a camp again or a cabin. So we are ripping off the sheetrock, ripping off all this stuff and making it back into a cabin. And I was literally just in a closet, you know, because we're trying to open it up. And there's a tin down there. And it was these candies from the Vermont store that were just still in there in this little tin. Of course, Chase ate one. It didn't look like it tasted so well, but it's amazing the stuff we find. Some of the oldest cabins are like on Belle Island in Cobbessey, like built in 1890. But the history is the coolest thing. Like we just found in this cabin right here, the old pole where everyone put their the kids' heights and stuff, you know, is buried. Stuff like that is just amazing.
Yeah, it really tells the story of a family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, ties in the whole camp thing. And so it's so cool.
Ian, Ryan mentions Cobbessey. Are there little pockets where the very first sort of communities of camps were, and where are those?
So it's really interesting to think about this idea of camps being sort of in the wilderness, because the irony and the flip side of this is the way to access these were often through modern technology. So some of the earliest camps were accessible by railroad. So it's funny to think that they developed sort of the idea of being sort of outside of society, but the only way to actually access them was society. So early ones were in Western Maine along railroads like the Grand Trunk, and further up into Central Maine on railroads that went through Bangor. But many of these railroads were established for industrial reasons, right? So logging railroads and that sort of thing. And the railroad companies figured out that they could make even more money by selling the woods that were owned by these lumber companies as vacation destinations as well, which happens to this day, right? The Great North Woods, for example, is owned mostly by timber companies, but are places where people go to outdoor recreate.
Mm. And I'll also jump on that too. The Bangor and Aroostook Railroad had this fantastic publication beginning in the early 20th century called In the Maine Woods. And essentially it was a promotional magazine, sort of ridership on the railroad up to camp. So it would include, you know, all the ads for all of the sporting camps. It would include articles about what types of clothing and materials and sort of accessories you would need. It would tell you where the biggest landings of fish were, where the best chances to hunt deer or caribou or moose were, all essentially getting people up into what we now like think of as the county, but really just to drive their ridership.
You know, it's interesting, Ryan, because I think that it sounds as though the early publicity for camps and things were really targeted toward people who lived in the big cities. But one of the things I was most surprised of when I moved to Maine 30 years ago is how many people live someplace and have a camp just a couple miles away. And, you know, camp is where they live in the summer, and then they move back to the house in the, you know, the town, even if the town's population is 300 or something for the rest of the year. And I'm wondering if that's what you're encountering again and again. Again, the whole idea that camp is a state of mind, it's not really even going very far away.
Right. We see that all the time. You know, some people, they go up north, but some people just go to the ocean. And, you know, the Moro family, it's funny, like, you know, they're a Clearwater Lake, and you know, their grandparents that started it, they lived in Augusta, so it wasn't that far away, but just that special place that they went. You know, and there's a lot of people I know that might even take an RV and go to camp out for this winter for the summer at, you know, a campground or something.
Yeah, yeah. And Catherine, you said you're married into a family with a camp. Is that why you picked your husband?
he would probably like think no. No. It's certainly a benefit and a plus nonetheless. But it's essentially, as Ryan was talking about, we live, both my husband and I and my in-laws live about an hour from the camp. We're there pretty much every weekend. We're there this past weekend, and it is sort of the social hub. And the fact of the matter is, you know, there, I think, are 12 or so properties now around this relatively small pond of all this big extended French Canadian family. So it's a homecoming essentially every single time we go to camp. There's cards being played until 2 a.m. in the morning. We're at somebody else's to sit around a fireplace. We're on the pontoon boat. You know, we're just enjoying all that the Maine outdoors have for us, but also spending real quality time with our families.
Yeah. And Ian, what about your family? Yeah, I was going to go.
I was just going to add one thing. I'll talk about my family as well. But, you know, the word vacation, we don't think about it, is the noun form of the word vacate, which means to leave, right? So if you're thinking about these places, even if it is only a few miles distant, it's about changing your latitude, changing your attitude, right? And being in a different place. So I live on Peaks Island, which is a place that many people come to visit in the summertime. And it's interesting because some of my neighbors who have seasonal places here live just in Portland and Munjoy Hill. So all they're taking is a 15-minute ferry ride, but it's a world away, right? It's about escaping a world away, even though they're not leaving the city of Portland's boundaries.
So a camp is about escape. And one of the things that is interesting, Catherine, and unfortunately, I fear may be changing, is that this really, the tradition of a Maine camp wasn't just for the socioeconomic elite. Mm-hmm. Many Maine families, many families that might be referred to as blue collar, had camps and have camps.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, you know, pulling from the example of my families, you know, these were blue collar workers in the mills in Rumford, who were first generation, you know, Americans coming down from Quebec. And they're able to, with a family of 12 children, you know, build a camp with scrap materials. And essentially, again, it's only a few miles away from their homesteads, but they're able to escape to it during the summer. But that is quickly becoming almost impossible, especially for those in the middle class. You know, we watch properties around the pond that now go for $300,000, $400,000, $500,000, sometimes $600,000. And that's not attainable for very few people. And a lot of it has been out-of-staters who have come in. And there was definitely an uptick during the pandemic, where again, there was this need to escape big cities, not unlike the folks, you know, over 100-150 years ago, who wanted to come to Maine because it was safe, it was clean. And that unfortunately has raised real estate values, raised property values, and we're finding it more and more difficult for folks to both retain their properties, but to even buy into it if they're interested.
And Ryan, I'm sure you're seeing this. I know that Maine Cabin Masters does a lot of things really frugally. You find a lot of great things to put into camps. But frugal isn't the name of the game for everybody, is it?
No, let's just talk about the elephant in the room real quick. We definitely are not helping keep Maine quiet. You know, our show is pretty popular, you know. But most of the people that do come here, you know, come here because they love what we value as a lifestyle that we need to have, you know. And a lot of people come here because they, you know, I was just thinking about how lucky we are. Like Ian was saying, I always think about the fact that I lived right here, but then these people come from all over the world to camp like 10 minutes from my house. You know, how amazing is that we live here? Sometimes you lose sight of that. Mm-hmm. And yet someone has a camp right down the road next to my house. Like, wow.
Yeah, they work hard all year to get to come there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we do have to take a break. We want to hear your experiences. We want you to share in your joy or frustration or great family stories about your camp. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on social media. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Today on the program, we are talking about going up to camp. It is a very Maine tradition. People who move here from somewhere else don't know what the phrase means. People who've grown up here don't realize that other people don't call it a camp. They call it a cabin or something like that. With me today, Ryan Eldridge with the team behind the Kennebec Cabin Company and the TV series Maine Cabin Masters. Ian Stevenson, an architectural historian who teaches at Boston University. And Catherine Sear, who is with Maine Maritime Museum, and she curated the exhibit there that is called Up to Camp. Share your comments and questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Andrea, who's calling from Mountville. Hi, Andrea. Go ahead.
Oh, hi, Jennifer. It's a pleasure being on the program. I was so excited to hear that this was about camps. My husband and I bought an old hunting camp on a dead-end road on Fry Mountain, which is also a game management preserve. And it was established as kind of a family compound for people that lived in Massachusetts and also Maine. But one of the family members decided to sell their camp, and I bought it, and my husband and I turned it into a really sweet cottage. So going up to camp is our permanent lifestyle. We started with an outhouse, and maybe 7 years ago we finally got indoor plumbing. But what's so great is we just live right in the middle of nature, near hiking trails and beaver ponds, and I've put in raised bed gardens, and what's really funny is we have neighbors that do come up to camp, and every weekend when they go home, they always say how sad they are, and they wish that they could stay, and we just look at them and smile and say, well, we've made it our lifestyle. Anyway, so thanks for having this program. I was just really excited to hear it was about camps.
Oh, Andrea, thanks so much. And Catherine, how common is that these days that camp isn't really camp anymore? Camp is home.
Yeah, absolutely. And that has been a change that's happened, especially just like this caller. You know, you love this place so much. You see the benefits of being in this area. And people decide to make it their year-round home. But I think that there's still an element in which you can still call it camp. Because the essence, the sort of theme is still there. You just get to be at camp all year round.
Andrea, thanks for your call. I wish you all who are listening right now could see what I see, because I am on a Zoom call with all these folks, and the whole Maine Cabin Masters crew has just joined Ryan. They're all looking in the window of the truck, and welcome to all of you. And I'm just wondering if, well, you're taking a break from the hard work you're doing and the TV show shooting, if there's anything any of you wants to add about what camp, the idea of camp means to you. Ryan, any of your colleagues close enough to the phone?
Come on. What does camp mean to you guys?
Camp's a place for friends and family to gather and enjoy the outdoors.
Really, for me, it's just escaping that every day, you know, the everyday reality that we all deal with and go through. And camp's just a great spot to go unplug and relax.
I think, listening to the last caller, it's definitely is more common for people after they start going to camp to want to make it into their home. So camp can be a lot of things.
Well, it's so fun to see all of you together in the field working on a project. I'm going to go to Sandra, who's calling from New Hampshire, but has a connection to Maine. Hi, Sandra. Go ahead.
Well, hello there. Yep, going to camp. That's it.
Go ahead. Do you have a story? Go ahead and share.
Sure. My family actually was on Great Pond probably early, 1917, in that range. And so I grew up going to camp every summer. And it was just great. August was in camp. And then my father bought a place around the corner from the original place. And so I've just been going to camp for years, decades.
Well, yeah, thanks for calling. And when you say Great Pond, do you mean Belgrade Lakes region?
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Thanks so much for calling in. And of course, Belgrade Lakes region, one of the classic places, one of the dozen or so classic places for Maine camps. Ian, I'll turn to you because you're an architectural historian. Is there an architectural style for a Maine camp?
I think this is a great question. And obviously there's a huge range, right? We've talked about small places that don't have electricity up to the large things. But it's interesting to me that what ends up becoming a dominant form is the log cabin, right? Now, it's not universal, but the log cabin is associated with sort of rustic and rusticity. And these promotional entrepreneurs even get involved with this. So I mentioned early railroads promoting camps. At Bemis, which is in the Rangeley area, the railroad actually builds a log cabin railroad station, the only one east of the Mississippi River, as a draw for tourists to come to Barker's sporting camps, which are just down the road. So it's not exclusively log construction, but the logs are there to sort of evoke the wilderness, right? This feeling that the building kind of almost belongs in the landscape itself. Becomes a dominant form in the 19th century.
Ryan, I'm going to have you add to that. How do you? And then I'll go to Catherine. How do you feel about log cabins? I'm guessing that they're they're expensive and they have some issues.
Yes, they do have a lot of issues, and there's not many people that fix them anymore either. So get a lot of calls about that. But the biggest thing is keeping them up off the ground. But it's the oldest cabin I think we've worked on was on Bell Island, and it was a tiny little log cabin that they had there, and it was 1890. And it was in amazing shape, except for the course around the bottom. But like Cabin Master style, we didn't know what we were doing. We just dug into it and figured it out and fixed it. But yeah, it's funny that
go ahead.
Say that now, taking sheetrock out of this place to make it a cabin.
Catherine, what would you like to add about log cabins?
Yeah, no, I just wanted to add that, through my research and thinking about camps architecturally and sort of how they are designed and built, the fact of the matter that the materials come from the site is really integral to a Maine camp being a Maine camp, because it's Maine essentially materials essentially part of the landscape and engulfing you totally in that wilderness feeling. And I do have a funny story about the bottom course of a log cabin being rotted. One of my visits was up to Spencer Pond Camps, way up north of Greenville. And one of their ways on their early 1900 cabin was they used treated telephone poles as the bottom course of the structure, essentially, because it would be rot resistant. And it was funny, as I was walking around and suddenly seeing all these little numbers on the bottom course and be like, what is this? And then the owner comes out, he's like, we just use telephone poles. And it's just like that Yankee ingenuity, of course, that, you find the materials that you have and you create a solution.
I love it.
I'll add one thing too, that I think it's in addition to what Catherine was saying about the materials and sort of being part of the landscape, the idea of a log cabin also kind of evokes this timeless nature, this kind of simpler past that you're going to escape society from as well, right? So the building helps transport you into both a location, but also a feeling and a time of sort of simplicity as well.
Here's an email from Amanda. The Industrial Revolution created quite a bit of pollution. Were the clean air and water of Maine's woods part of the draw? We've talked about how it was the late 1800s when this came to be a thing. Catherine, is that what you found, that people were escaping soot and pollution?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, kind of harkening back to something Ian said earlier, the problem is they had to create more of that soot and pollution to get up to camp. But certainly there was, even dating back to the early 1800s, the idea of taking the airs, taking the baths, going to hot springs, finding the like sort of wellness and holistic qualities of the environment and of nature certainly transpired into the late 19th century, and folks realizing that Maine offered, again, this sort of unbelievable and untethered sort of sense of just its thousands of bodies of water, multiple acres of open forest. And so certainly there is the impression that folks definitely came for those reasons.
We have an email here from Lisa with up to camp tips. I'm going to read them slowly because they're all kind of funny on their own. The first one is take the second plate in the stack. Another one is keep the glasses upside down. Check the stove before preheating. Find a third party to deal with the camp chores and finances if inherited by siblings. So, you know, when she said check the stove before preheating, Ryan, I saw you laughing. I can only imagine what you found in stoves.
We were all three of those are perfect, amazing, because our little buddies, mice, you know, and rodents, and they get everywhere. You know, and you get so excited to get to camp.
They're part of the package of camp.
But that is great advice. I never thought about that. Just take the second plate. And even if it's only been a week, you know, sometimes you don't get back to camp for a couple of weeks. They're at camp all the time.
The mice don't ever move out. They don't go just for the summer. We're going to go to Diane, who's calling from Brunswick. Hi, Diane. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a camp on East Pond, and we've had it for a little over a decade. And the important thing about camp was during COVID, it provided us with a place to go when we were going stir crazy at home.
Yeah. Boy, I bet there are a lot of people who are envious of you. And Catherine, you're nodding because it seems as though the harder times are and the more of a mental break we need, the more important camps are.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that just comes from that necessary need to escape. And of course, we've all lived through the past 4 years and know how crazy and stressful it has been. And I think that's the reason why, you know, folks all around the country, you know, connect to shows like the Maine Cabin Masters, because they see what we have. It's so lucky to be able to escape to, even if it's, like we said, a couple miles from our house, or, you know, maybe a 6 hour drive. We're just, it's there for us to have.
And we have, if I could add one ahead, thing, Ryan. You know, we talked about the sort of health aspects, and Catherine explained sort of the idea of the clean air and the clean water, but there's a psychological aspect as well. You know, this is the place where Thoreau came to sort of figure out sort of how wilderness as a place, as an escape, has like a restorative capacity that's beyond just the sort of health of the air and the water, but just being in a place where you can sort of contemplate and escape the sort of pressures of society as well.
Diane, thanks for calling in. Leslie on Facebook writes, love this show. Thrilled you have Ryan Eldridge on. My grandparents bought a camp on Patty Pond in the mid-60s, which is still used by family. As non-Mainers, my side of the family had to learn a lot about Mainers and why they bought a place so close to where they live. That's what we were talking about. And then an email, Donna writes, I live in Maine year-round, and I have a camp on Long Pond surrounded by Acadia National Park. My home is only 15 minutes away. It's a place I seek to slow down, relax, simplify, enjoy all the simple pleasures life has to offer with friends and family. Over the years, I've learned that many others who have a similar situation actually rent theirs out for the month of July and August so that they can afford to live in Maine altogether. This is becoming more and more of a trend as real estate prices skyrocket. So I'm going to turn back to you, Ryan. Is that what you're seeing? People own a camp, but they rent it for the best months.
Yeah, we are seeing some of that. I mean, it beats the alternative, you know, having to sell it. And I think that started happening on the coast even before since the pandemic, prices in Maine on all real estate have gone up. But the coast, they were really getting priced out, the working waterfronts and stuff. And I think, you know, I don't see anything wrong with that. Anything you can do to save the family camp, you know, give it a week. It's a lot to give up the best weeks too, but it just shows you how much the camp will mean to you, you know. Mm. Who knows what the market's going to do. I don't see Maine's popularity just keeps getting bigger and bigger, and more younger people are coming here, which I think is amazing, you know. And Central Maine is getting more popular, and like it's a great place, and it's a double edged sword, you know. We love it, word's out, but
yeah. And Ryan, I wouldn't feel too guilty. I think word was out already.
Oh yeah, before got the real expert here now with me, Chase.
The state adopted the motto "Vacation Land" in 1916, so we've been promoting ourselves.
Yeah, well over 100 years.
Chase has taken my spot for a little bit. I'm needed, guys.
All right, we'll go back to the job site and hi to Chase. We are going to take a quick break. We're talking about camp, and when I say camp, I mean, you know, up to camp. Phone number 1-800-399-3566, or find us on social media, or send a quick email to talk@mainpublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and we are talking about going up to camp on Maine Calling today. Joining us for the hour, Catherine Sear, who's a curator at the Maine Maritime Museum, and she put together the current exhibit, Up to Camp. Ian Stevenson is a lecturer in preservation studies at Boston University. And Ryan has left us. Who is joining us now? Introduce yourself, please.
So it's Chase joining you, Chase Morrill.
Oh, Chase Morrill, thanks so much for being here with us. And before we go back to the calls, wondering if there's anything you want to add that Ryan didn't tell us about. Any camp that you've worked on that's particularly memorable or, you know, stays with you?
I think a little bit of each camp stays with us, whether it's the debris that gets stuck in our pockets of our clothing or in our shoes. But, you know, we're just happy to be working in the state and preserving a lot of these camps. You know, we're working in places that, you know, most people don't really know how to take care of, not take care of, but how to renovate, you know, because of its proximity to the water, its location. And that's where we kind of come in and help save these camps.
An email here from the writer, Amy White Chapman. She writes, I'm in the process of completing a book titled Just Like Glass, which will be published later this year, about my parents, our camp on North Pond in Woodstock, and what it has meant and continues to mean to me. These are the opening words. In 1954, my parents bought a lakefront lot in western Maine for $200, cleared and leveled a building site, and began with the help of their four kids, ages 4 to 10, to build what we have always called camp. It was never meant to be a cottage or a lake house. It was just camp, with exposed rafters and tiny bedrooms and an open loft full of lumpy beds. So I love that. And I'll go back to you, Chase. Would you say that those are some of the prerequisites? We have to have exposed rafters and tiny bedrooms?
Absolutely. And it's also a family project. I mean, that really is what camp is all about, gathering with friends and family and making do with what you have. You know, if you go up for a summer and build a small structure and next summer you need more space, you enlist as many people as you can and find whatever materials you can and expand as needed. We've renovated so many of that camps. And again, you know, they're still standing or they've just morphed and changed through the years, modifications, whatever. But we try and, again, we try and keep these camps going for families, for future generations.
Catherine, I want to sort of step back a minute before we go back to the callers and ask you, what do you hope people come away from the exhibit if they go to Maine Maritime this summer? And maybe they go to the Maine Maritime exhibit expecting to see, you know, exhibits about schooners and U-boats and they find instead an exhibit about camp. Explain to me why that's at the Maine Maritime Museum and what you're hoping people learn.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one of the first things I try to remind people is that I think we all have this sort of understanding that Bath is on the coast and it's in the mid-coast. It's just sort of what we think. But the reality is the museum and our site sits on the Kennebec River. Yes, it's tidal at this point, but if you follow the Kennebec River all the way up, you end up in Moosehead. And since our founding in the 1960s, the museum has been collecting materials related to inland waterways. So this is an opportunity to expand the narrative a bit more and think a bit more broadly about what the sort of impact on Maine's waterways has had. And we talk about the tourism and the industry of our coastline, but that travels up inland as well. And so this exhibit is an opportunity for folks to, if they have never heard about camp before, learn about why it came to be and what you can do at it. But if they are familiar with camp and you know, perhaps are on their way up to one when they stop in at the museum, a place to reconnect, to relive their memories, and to sort of think about what camp means to them.
I'm going to go to an email here from Ken. Please ask your guests to assess the state of classic sporting, hunting and fishing camps of Maine. Are they an endangered species? Ian, I'll turn to you.
I'm thrilled. I'm glad. I was hoping that we would cover this because this is a related but also a different animal altogether, because these are for-profit entities that are appealing to people in state, but also largely out-of-staters, you know, the so-called sports of the late 19th and early 20th century. And they have their heyday in that era. There are still a sizable collection of sporting camps, and I frequent these myself, but I would say that it's increasingly becoming an endangered species. The number of these in the state is declining. And when they close, they don't reopen. So Maine still has a significant heritage of this, but it is becoming something that is dwindling as part of our landscape, I'm afraid.
Yeah, there's actually some good statistics on this as well. We know that in 1904, there were over 300 sporting camps in the state. As of now, there are a couple of dozen. And so they have significantly dwindled. And that's for a number of reasons. Some of them get sold off and become private entities, and people buy sleeping cabins and they become their own private camps, as we've been sort of talking about today. Sometimes it's the family can no longer, you know, just keep up with the maintenance of it. It's finding staff who can be in these rural locations. It's competition with Airbnb and Vrbo. You know, you think about some of these really remote places, their access to internet isn't that great. How are they able to market to the same extent of somebody else who can, you know, post their home or their own camp on these sort of letting sites? And so they're very much an endangered species, if we're going to kind of use that terminology, but ones that have historical significance to tourism in the state and leisure, you know, activities in the state. And, you know, unfortunately, they just kind of keep falling. I know there was one that I visited back in 2021 that is for sale now, and I'm afraid that the land underneath the camps far, far more valuable than the buildings themselves. And I'm really afraid of what that 100-year legacy of that camp is going to turn into when some either big developer comes in and wipes out these historic structures.
I will add that there is a Maine Sporting Camps Association. So owners have been working together to find solutions maybe across the state to help sort of increase promotion and tourism and that sort of thing, to sort of find mutual solutions for problems they're facing.
We're going to go to Scott calling from Peaks Island. Hi, Scott. Go ahead.
Hello. This is a great subject. I'm the executive director of the Illustration Institute on Peaks Island. We have a artist residency out here that started as a camp, but then turned into a bohemian enclave. And I'd like to talk about this, how this can also, you know, camps can be an organizing principle around ideas. And this one, to me, is a testament to the power of romance. It was started by Frederick Whitney, who was a socialist, had correspondence with Eugene Debs, and his wife was, and I'm not being glib here, was a socialite. And she was really interested in the arts. And through his love for her, he was able to develop, he developed basically 9 buildings that were made from all sorts of counterintuitive materials. He brought in stone from New Hampshire to build the stone house. He built a 60-foot viewing tower so he could see Mount Washington from the place. And they invited artists from New York and Boston to this island.
Well, Scott, thanks for calling. Yeah, and aren't you lucky to be a part of that? That's wonderful. It reminds me of maybe some of the artist colonies, for example, in Monhegan and down in Ogunquit. Thanks so much for calling. We're going to go to David, who's calling from the road. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I own a summer home with my sister. We're fourth generation. Of course, my grandkids are sixth generation. And that's what happens after the the folks pass on, there's only so many homes, there's only so much land if you had the money to build a new one. And it started back over a century ago when usually wealthy businessmen from Boston built cottages for their families to stay in for the 10 weeks, the hottest weeks in the summer. And they commuted back and forth some on the steamship. I don't think this applies to inland areas because they are, I think, pretty much or almost as hot and humid as Boston. And back then you couldn't get there from air. You have to take the boat and the train another boat and whatever.
Yeah, but I've seen the pictures kind of the steamships coming into Acadia. And I'm sorry to cut you off, David, but we have so many calls and not that much time left. But Ian, it is a bit of a different story, right? The coast is the wealthy, the people from Philadelphia, the people from Boston and New York coming up on a steamship and building but inland, it's a whole different story, right? The lakes and ponds.
Yeah, that's right. Except for the wealthy sports who want to engage with this sort of masculine activity of hunting and fishing, right? So the wealthy will go up into these sporting camps and spend a lot of money at them. And the sporting camps have a rustic aspect where you're staying in a rustic cabin, but then you're having these, you know, multi-course meals. It's called the American Plan at the lodge, yeah, which is lobster and steak and it's being served with white tablecloth service, and you're hiring an expensive guide to take you out all day. So
right.
They are appealing to that wealthy class who, again, are trying to reassert this kind of masculinity they feel is being lost when working a day job in a desk all day and wanting to get into this kind of rugged outdoors.
David, thanks for your call. We're going to try to squeeze in another call. Go to Richard in Yarmouth. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hi, I had a question I want to pose to the cabin master folks, having to do with building codes, because it seems like building codes are very variable all over the state, and I've run into some strange things with my own place. I have a place on an island off of Portland that I share with my sister, and I met my wife out there, and her family has a place as well. So, but I'm finding that their building codes are variable, they're interestingly enforced, and I'm just curious how what their comments are about what the effect of the building code situation is on renovating these camps and how people can work on them, improve them, repair them, whatever, given all the code stuff. And I assume it's pretty variable all over the state.
Right. Go ahead, Chase.
Yeah, that's enough for a whole nother conversation right there alone. So Maine has shoreland zoning, which covers water bodies and close to water bodies through the entire state. Then each town has each town does have its own set of guidelines. Best thing you can do is check with this town, your local code enforcement officer before you get started. But we're working on seasonal properties. So, you know, a lot of the uniform building codes, you know, they don't apply because they're seasonal, and mostly what we're doing is renovation, but we always make sure we have the proper permits in place. You know, when we're working close to the water, we want to make sure we're being seen, we're setting an example. So we always make sure what we do is, you know, to the best of our ability, up to code. But again, you know, we can be working in one town, think we've got it figured out, go to the next town, they're like, nope, that's not how we do it. So again, checking with your town is always the first step.
Richard, thanks for your call. An email here from Todd. Up to camp was an ethic in my family. Started with my grandmother's family growing up in Pittsburgh. They had cabins in Bradford Woods, and the photos and lore of their family summers there persists in my own imagination. In my generation, we went up to camp on the Saco River near North Conway. That special A-frame perched above the river persists in my heart, along with bird songs and the sound of the river. And then Michael writes, we winterized and expanded our original 20 by 30 foot Ward log cabin in the county, but we still think of it as a camp. My son in New York likes to tell his friends it is a lake house. It is not. It's a camp. When our grandson first saw inside, he said, Nana, it's so woody. Now retired, I like to call our South Portland condo our winter camp. That way we can be at camp all year long. So again, from Michael, the idea that camp is a state of mind. And Catherine, in your research, is that the conclusion you came up with?
Yeah, I think one of my favorite definitions of what camp is that it's sort of elusive. You know, every single person has a different definition of what camp means to them or what camp is to them. And that, I think, is what makes it such a unique and staple for Mainers and those who come and visit the state. It's just, you know, that essence. And I really like Ryan's bit of it's a state of mind, but in a specific place. I think I'm going to use that in the future.
And I'm going to wrap up with you, Ian. We have 30 seconds. So we've already, Chase and I have already determined that we have to have small bedrooms and exposed timbers. What else is absolutely necessary in a camp? Do we need some sort of animal on the wall?
Well, not necessarily an animal, but you have to have a way to engage with the nature from the building itself. So you need some sort of porch or covered deck or outside space so you can take in the surroundings when you're at camp.
Okay, well, thank you all so much. And I'm so sorry for all of you who sent lovely emails and we weren't able to get to them. Very popular program. Chase Morrill with us for the second half of the hour. And I really appreciate the folks from Maine Cabin Masters joining us from the field. They are working on a project and they are being filmed. Catherine Sear is the associate curator who created the Up to Camp exhibit at the Maine Maritime Museum. And it's there till November 28th. And Ian Stevenson, a lecturer in preservation studies at Boston University. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, we are going to rebroadcast my conversation with author Monica Wood about her wonderful new novel. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you have been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.